Well, folks, we're getting close to the end, and this is our last plenary entitled Challenges to Christians Practicing the Peace of Christ in the Nation. Our two presenters, George Kalantzis, teaches at Wheaton. George and I go way back, friends for a long time, since 8 o'clock this morning. And which means in our American culture that we'll be besties by noon. George teaches historical theology and patristics, which means he knows a little bit about what the church has thought about these issues and many more for a long time. And his perhaps was the first name that came up when we started talking about this as a planning team. And since there's other smart people on the planning team, I really respect their opinion. And so I'm looking forward to hearing what George has to say. Steve Fowle is someone that the Ecclesia Project has known for a long time board member, long time participant. He's a go-to guy for if you have questions about what, if you don't drink beer and you want to know what kind of beer to serve to people, then you can call Steve, and he's gracious enough to actually treat it like it's a real question. And the first time I met Steve, a book that he co-authored called Reading and Communion continues to shape the life of our congregation. And his wisdom has continued to contribute in many ways to our congregation. And so the first meeting, walking down the street of Chicago, just talking to him like a regular guy, him telling us about his family night and what they do, I came back and talked to my wife, Lisa, and said, I just walked and had a talk with Steve Fowle. And she wasn't really that impressed, Steve, so sorry.
Smarter than you are.
Yeah, well, that doesn't say much. So anyway, Steve teaches at Loyal University of Maryland, teaches, I'm sure, a bunch of stuff. He is the Ecclesia Project's go-to guy when we talk about Scripture and we want a wise word about Scripture. Steve's our guy, and we're grateful to him. And I have no idea what these guys will say today, but I am confident that it will be with wisdom and grace. And so let's hear them.
We're going to try, Steve and I have worked months and months on this since 8 o'clock this morning. Longer than that, 70. We will try to have a discussion, and we invite you to be in discussion with us. So let me introduce myself a little bit. I'm George Kalantzis. I work at Wheaton. Steve is an alumnus of Wheaton, so this is the Wheaton panel tonight. I thought for a moment bringing Wheaton shirts, but that would be a bit too much. We're going to talk about peace in our nations. From my accent, you can hear I wasn't born and raised in the Midwest. I was born and raised in Greece, where our Constitution begins not with a preamble like the U.S. Constitution, but the very first three lines of the Greek Constitution are in the name of the Holy Triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. These are the laws of the nation of Greece. So immediately we talk about a nation in which God, church, country are all wrapped into one. That means that growing up, especially as an evangelical in the north of the country, one has quite of a confused relationship with those two themes that weave together. I am a grandson of a police officer. My grandfather was a general in the Greek police, and a son of a Navy captain. I served in the army. We have conscription in Greece, And I had never thought about what does it mean to be a Christian first and anything else before that until two things happened. First, I went and presented myself with basic training, but I did that at the age of 31. I had educational deferment until then, and even though I had volunteered for the paratroopers, they said, you're old enough, too old, decrepit and crazy, so we don't want you for that. But I did serve. That was the first one. The second one was, because I was 31 years old, I started listening to what we were being told in basic training. I mean, what was the narrative that was being said in order to prepare young men for war? And you hear it very differently at 30 than you do at 17. It's a completely different story. The whole narrative, as we're going to talk about, was a very different thing, including the fact that they wanted to persuade us for 93 days in a row that the Turks, which is our natural, quote, enemy in Greece, want our homes, want our families, want the land in which we are. And the weird thing for me was, after a while, it starts making sense. But it shouldn't. So, we'll talk more about that. Steve is going to begin our time, and we'll go back and forth in discussion like that.
Not quite as tall as George. I think I can speak for George, and certainly for myself, that we sat back there listening to Mike and Stan yesterday, growing increasingly disappointed as every single point we decided to make was brought out by them. I think we had the hope, which by then was a very vain hope, that we would get to go first so that they would seem derivative, unimaginative, and parasitic. Unfortunately, that falls to us. As George and I thought about what we wanted to say and how we wanted to say it and how we wanted to present things, several things became clear to us. First, for the most part, we're preaching to the choir. We recognize that a commitment to the nonviolent practice of the peace of Christ is central to the Ecclesia Project and to its members. Second, although nonviolence is deeply woven into the fabric of the EP, many of us worship in churches where that's not the case. In our churches, we will offer each other the peace of Christ in worship, but relatively few of us worship in churches that endorse nonviolence in their canons and confessional statements. Moreover, despite any stance our respective churches might take, we all inhabit as pilgrims a country that's currently engaged in a variety of wars of varying temperatures. And our focus is practicing the peace of Christ in the nation. Finally, we're aware that the two of us together, and George much more than me, represent only a very small portion of the spiritual, moral, and intellectual resources in the room. As a result, we thought it would be worthwhile for the two of us to make a short list of the various habits, spiritual, practical, and intellectual, that one might find in churches or in the wider culture that can either hinder or enhance our practice of the peace of Christ. We came up with a list of eight things. There are, no doubt, other things, but these emerged fairly quickly for us. We divided them up between us and decided we would speak very briefly about each of these as a way of offering them up to you all for further discussion. By aiming to speak provocatively and briefly, we hope that there'll be sufficient time and material for a lively discussion. So I'm going to begin and do a couple, and then George will do some, and then I'll come back. As we Christians seek to practice the peace of Christ in this nation, we can fall into the temptation to evaluate our practice according to its effectiveness. Here's how this might arise, though it can arise for a lot of ways. even when their motives are less than transparent, nations and alliances of nations go to war for reasons. They have goals and objectives, even if they're not always forthcoming about their true goals and objectives. And even if those goals and objectives change over time, there are still goals and objectives there. And in this way, governments invite their citizens both to offer up their bodies to fight and to be able to offer some sort of evaluation of their war making by how effectively they achieve those goals. When, as Christians, begin to question, criticize, and resist the call to war and the practice of war, and to advocate for peace, there's a great temptation in that set of practices to allow our peacemaking to be evaluated according to analogous standards of effectiveness. Such effectiveness can take the form of numbers of demonstrations staged, legislation passed, policies enacted, all designed to stop or reduce the overall level of violence. In short, we can find that we are asked by others, or sometimes begin to ask ourselves, questions like these. If peace is our goal, how effective were our actions in achieving that goal? Or if peacemaking is a real alternative to war making, then shouldn't it be evaluated in much the same way we evaluate war making? That is, did it achieve its stated aims? If not, how can we practice peacemaking in better ways? How can our peacemaking be altered, modified, or changed in order to make it more effective? If Christians fall into this habit of thinking, we may find ourselves pushed to admit that if we simply cannot find a way to make peacemaking more effective, then maybe we ought to abandon it as an unworkable goal. To address this temptation, Christians can remind themselves that when Jesus calls his followers to abandon violence, he does so without regard to result. Indeed, if his own commitment to nonviolence is to be a sign and example for us, we can expect increased violence in the light of our abandonment of violence. For Christians, forswearing violence is a matter of fidelity and not effectiveness. It's a matter of bearing witness to God's deepest longings for the world as displayed in creation, longings fully embodied in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, and longings which will ultimately be realized when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. Indeed, when we're reminded of this movement from creation through to consummation, we realize that while we faithfully witness to peace in word and deed, God is the one who will ultimately bring about this peace. Such a realization should not lead us to abandon acting, advocating, hoping, and praying for peace in this and every other nation, but it does remind us that our practice is evaluated in terms of faithfulness and not effectiveness. The second issue I'm going to talk about before handing over to George is concerns habits of sacrifice. In some respects, this issue is as relevant for those Christians who adhere to some version of just war thinking, as well as to those who are committed to nonviolence. One cannot imagine that a commitment to nonviolence will be cost-free. A commitment to nonviolence, or even a commitment to limiting one's recourse to violence, will inevitably open us to suffering, deprivation, and even violence. More painfully, it may also open others we love and care about to suffering, deprivation, and violence. A commitment to practicing the peace of Christ will, in all likelihood, lead to innocent suffering, even on the part of those who have no interest in the peace of Christ. And it's here, in the face of such suffering, that arguments about the effectiveness of peacemaking really gain traction. In response to this, we should also recognize that apart from a willingness to be formed in habits of sacrifice and dispossession, it will be very difficult to practice the peace of Christ in this or any nation. Now, having said that, I want to offer some qualifying comments. Both in his life and his teaching, Jesus absorbs the violence directed at him by the world without passing it on as violence. In this way, he's able to offer his life back to God as a sacrifice. Jesus wills to become the world's victim. And this is the primary context within which his followers form habits of sacrifice and dispossession. It seems necessary to say that, but saying that's not enough. We're all aware of those who are victimized by violence of all types. We may be such victims ourselves. Moreover, we either know or can probably guess how painful and damaging it is simply to absorb violence unwillingly and with no further recourse. This damage can be seen in persons, in neighborhoods, in nations. Absorbing violence unwillingly with no further recourse almost always results in violence that is eventually passed on as violence, either in self-harm or in abuse or in vengeance. At the very least, to follow Christ's example of absorbing violence without passing it on as violence requires the ability and the opportunity to speak truthfully about the violence to which one is subjected. My conviction is that this can only happen when there are genuine, workable structures of confession, forgiveness, reconciliation, and an enduring faith in God's providence. Ideally, victims will be able to speak truthfully about the violence they encounter, but it seems to me at least as realistic, if not more realistic, that others may need to intervene at crucial points to get that conversation going. This can't be a sugar-coated or politically expedient glossing of the truth that simply stops the violence, keeping both victim and victimizer in precisely the same place they started. Instead, it requires truthful speech. And in the light of such truthful speech, victimizers need to be offered paths to pursue repentance and reconciliation. And just to make things more difficult, we often can't imagine such things happening and can't begin to initiate those practices apart from a firm faith in God's gracious and providential care. And in the absence of these, it becomes very difficult to sustain the habits of sacrifice and dispossession needed to practice the peace of Christ.
So what about Romans 13? I live in a world of patristics, which is roughly the first 5 or 6 centuries of the life of the church. My students sometimes say I never come out of that world, but that's what, we'll leave that aside. When we engage these discussions, and especially when we tend to concentrate on one's national or topographical relationship and identity, we forget that these are the same questions Christians, not only Christians, but Christians in particular, have been asking for 2,000 years from the beginning. These are not new questions, from weapons of mass destruction to the relationship with Caesar. When we think of the early church, and we think of the stories of martyrs, and we think of the stories of the writers of the early church, none of which, up to the middle of the 4th century, none of them supported or so any possibility of a Christian involvement in the structures of state, not only military, but also state relationships. And I will speak more to that later on when I will speak a little bit, make the connection more with civic service and say that that too is part of participating in a violent, coercive relationship. We have to remember that the stories of these persons and their stories are not just naive and idealistic bishops and academic theologians blind to the affairs of the world. There were people who had experienced the cruelty of war and persecution. Justin, for example, is called the martyr for a reason. Origen and Tertullian had witnessed the cruelty of the Septimian persecution, the imprisonment, torture, and execution of family members and fellow Christians. Origen was stretched 3 pegs. Think about it, about 3 inches, and suffered and died 4 years later. Irenaeus was the presbyter of the church in Lyon when members of his own congregation were condemned ad bestias. Cyprian was beheaded. They understood that wars were inevitable and that social order may necessitate violence on the part of the magistracy, but they also understood that that was not an option for the Christian. Theirs was a realized eschatology in which the martyr participated already in the events of the eschaton, to the sacrifice of incense and grain demanded by the state as signs of loyalty. Christian martyrs offered an alternative sacrifice that rejected these illusory claims and guaranteed true eternal peace. They offered themselves in imitation of Christ. The first account of a Christian martyr is the stoning of Stephen, Acts 6 through 8, and the earliest recorded prayer for the church, for the state by the church, is in the first letter of Clement, sent by the Church of Rome to the Church of Corinth in the end of the first century. Scarcely a generation earlier, Paul had written to the churches in Rome, quote, "Be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God." And most often, Romans 13, 1 and forward. And most times when I speak, and certain when you speak, this is the trump card that is coming out. What about Romans 13? Paul had also instructed the Romans to pray for all what is due, to pay to all what is due to them. Taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due. Jesus had talked about rendering to Caesar what is Caesar's, and we'll come back to that in Matthew 22. To these, Peter had added, "For the Lord's sake, accept the authority of every human institution, whether of the emperor supreme or the governors, as sent by him to punish those who do wrong and praise those who do right. Honor everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor." 1 Peter 2. So how do we read? We have to remember, though, that it was the same Peter who, along with John, defined for the Christian community what honoring the governing authorities meant and why submitting oneself to the authorities did not mean acquiescing to the demands of the state. Following the example of Jesus before the Sanhedrin and Pilate, Peter and John affirmed that obedience to the command of God superseded the order to the state, of the state. "We must obey God rather than any human authority," they said in Acts 5, 29. With this seemingly simple declaration, the apostles exposed the true nature of the conflict that identified every other authority, secular or religious, as subordinate to God. The good news of God's imminent kingdom, in Mark 1:15, was interpreted as the rejection of one emperor, Caesar, by the proclamation of another, Jesus. Unlike the Maccabees, though, and here is where history is so important for us, unlike the Maccabees who rebelled against Hellenistic domination because of the Seleucid imposition of religious practices antithetical to Judaism, Christians never rebelled. And that was an idiom to which Christian apologists returned time and time again. The apostles neither rebelled against Rome nor sought a particular national identity separate from the eschatological kingdom of Christ. The witness of the New Testament and the early Christians was not one of autonomous Christian political order, and yet it was a wholly new political order. Christians insisted they were taught to respect the authorities. Christians had never rebelled, said Tertullian. On the contrary, they were not seditious. They did not take revenge. They did not even resist, for they were taught differently. They honored the emperor by putting him in his proper place under God, and commending him to divine favor. I will honor the emperor, wrote Theophilus of Antioch at the end of the second century, not by worshiping him, by offering prayers for him. He's not God. He's a man whom God has appointed to give just judgment, not to be worshipped. The distinction is crucial. The emperor has to be given authority by God to govern according to God's justice, not Rome's justice. Romans 13 is about governing according to God's justice, not Rome's or any other state's justice. Throughout the writings of this period, the point is made frequently that it is God who appoints the king and who dispenses kingdoms. And it is God, to this God, that Christians own their loyalty and in whose kingdom they held citizenship. As for now, the letter to Diognetus tells us at the beginning of the second century, Christians live in their own countries, but only as non-residents. They participate in everything as citizens and endure everything as foreigners. They live on earth, but their citizenship is heaven. Christians honor the emperor and the governing authorities as his appointed authorities, not by acquiescing to the demands of the state, but by following the example of Christ in refusing their consent and in submitting themselves to the consequence of that rejection, including scourging and death. That is what rendering to Caesar what is Caesar's would look like in a new economy. A simultaneous yes and no that points back to God as supreme. In doing so, they overturn one of the normative paradigms of the classical traditions and showed that for Christians, power is gained through submission, not violence. This was a truly countercultural movement the world around them, the Greco-Romans, could not understand. The Christian refusal to submit to the order of the emperor, obey the law, honor the gods, and practice the public rituals of civic religion that preserved order was seen by the Romans as an act of civic and religious blasphemy. It was an act of sedition, or that is how the state saw it. Christians, however, insisted that their refusal to acquiesce to the simulacra of justice and worship ought not to be interpreted as subversion or disloyalty, but as a call to the state to repent and acknowledge its proper place under the authority of God. It was civil disobedience. The first principle of civil disobedience is the proposition that one cannot act contrary to conscience, even under compulsion. An equally important feature of civil disobedience is its nonviolence. An interconnected and incontestable principle early Christians inherited from the teaching of Christ in the New Testament, for example, Matthew 26. These two, then, civil disobedience and nonviolence, go hand in hand throughout the stories that formed the character and identity of the earliest church. So, the second point that we wanted to make was that fearing God, honoring Caesar, means that you're going to die for God. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Steve spoke about sacrifice. Many times in our introductory texts, in our thinking of early Christians, we think of them as refusing to offer a sacrifice to the gods of Rome, to the gods around them, to the gods that don't exist. I want to propose that that is not true. Martyrdom was not the fate of the powerless, or their refusal to sacrifice. Martyrdom for the early Christians was an alternate form of sacrifice. It was a public transcript in which they presented themselves as a sacrifice given to God. It was a simultaneous no and yes to the demands of the state. Martyrdom, and here's what they inherited from Jesus, only counted and only was praised in the early church and throughout the history of the church if it was voluntary. Remember that. Tertullian writes a long treatise against this. Please don't go out and volunteer to be martyred, that he says, because that leads to bad things every time. But when people come and ask you, you stand up and say, yes, I will die for Christ. Martyrdom was not the fate of the powerless. It was not the fate which Jesus received because of historical confluence of facts in which Rome and the religious authorities overpowered him. the victims in the arenas in which Christians were put to be eaten and to be killed differed from the gladiators and the execution of the slaves that happened with them, by them, beside them. One group was powerless. The other group was powerful. In every single martyrdom account that comes to us from early Christianity, there is always a moment of transition in which, to take the words of Irenaeus or the words of Tertullian, injustice recognizes justice. It is that moment of transposition of power in which the state realizes, the audience realizes, that even though we can kill you, we have no power over you. And the moment in which the Christian martyr says, what's the worst thing you can do to me? Kill me? Okay, that's all the power you have. Those finally forced to submit to the grandeur of the state were not what the Romans expected. The Romans, the world around them, around the early Christians, had learned that the state is powerful, omnipotent, people submit to the state. When Roman legions marched, people feared. And the Christian said, you got nothing. You got nothing. That was a public transcript, a transposition of power, a social event in which the Christian showed that the truth, the hope, the presence of the resurrected Christ was what guided them, not fear of death. Christian nonviolence is not simply the stop of violence. Christian nonviolence and Christian submission of the self in front of the threat of violence is a witness to the resurrection of Christ, to the event that says publicly for all to see that for Christians, the day we die is just another day. It's not the end of something, the beginning of something. It's just a Tuesday. Because we participate already through our baptism in the life of Christ. Christians are called to be peacemakers. And for the early writers, that irenopoetic articulation of the kingdom on earth has its roots in the understanding of the imminence of the eschaton and the very character of Jesus. And that, for Christians, historically has been not only public, but what it meant to be nonviolent.
The next two issues are interrelated. The first has to do with the Catholicity of the Church in the face of empires and nation states, and the second has to do with the loyalties Christians may owe to the nation state. All of us live our lives within nation states or would-be nation states. Sometimes these change. Sometimes those changes are temporary, sometimes permanent. Sometimes we make those changes willingly, and sometimes they're forced upon us. Nevertheless, our earthly homes are found within nation states. And despite our best efforts to nationalize and domesticate the church is transnational. When Christians confess their faith in one holy, Catholic, and apostolic church, that adjective Catholic signifies, among other things, that there are no geographical limits on the mission, scope, interests, obligations, love, and authority of the church. Nations have borders, the church does not. Now, it seems easier, perhaps, for us to grasp the transnational character of the church when it comes to thinking about such matters as missionary activity and development work. Even here, however, there numerous examples, far too many examples, of Christians engaging in missionary or development work in ways that primarily advance the interests of nation states. It seems much harder to grasp, appreciate, and act upon the transnational character of the church when it comes to state-sponsored violence and warfare. I suspect at least a part of that difficulty of recognizing the Catholicity of the Church in the face of war has to do with the great significance that just war thinking places on the role of appropriate authorities in declaring any particular war to be justified. The just war tradition has tended to invest such authority in the leaders of nation states, and those folks' interests rarely coincide with the hopes of the Catholic Church, the Church Catholic. More practically, nation states have way more power than the Church to control the language and presentation of warfare. The Church is overmatched in that regard. The avenues for the production of images, for controlling the words that are said, and the ways that people think about war, in that battle, the Church is wildly overmatched by the nation state. So the nation state has a lot more power to impose borders on our thinking than it would appear our Confession of a Catholic Church has. And particularly in the modern period, Christians have often tended to hand over judgments about violence and war-making to the nation. And the interests and the concerns of the nation are decidedly not Catholic. Christians today in the U.S. or in any country that is at war have the particularly difficult task of trying to practice the peace of Christ in a way that recognizes that our Catholic confession ties us to believers in Iraq and Afghanistan and Cuba and elsewhere in ways far deeper than our connection to many of those living next door to us. This will make us feel both disconnected from our brothers and sisters abroad and alienated from our neighbors. We face a two-sided temptation here. On the one hand, there's the enormous temptation to label our unknown brothers and sisters abroad as enemies, simply by virtue of the borders within which we find ourselves and they find themselves. And on the other hand, we have to resist the temptation to disdain our neighbors, both within and without the Church, who to one degree or another are caught up in the idolatry of the nation and cannot abide the practice of the peace of Christ. And a final issue I want to touch on before handing things over back to George is related to the transnational Catholicity of the Church. This has to do with the loyalty sought by nation states, often under the guise of rendering to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. To this end, I want to relate two stories that arise out of teaching at Loyola. Many of you will know that Loyola is run by the Society of Jesus. Most of our students, about 75% of them, are Roman Catholic, at least when it comes to checking a box on a form. All of them, no matter what their major, have to take Introduction to Theology as well as one other theology course. So every student who graduates from Loyola passes through our departments. And for the vast majority of them, Scripture is foreign territory. Now, there are some pedagogical benefits to this. They know that Scripture is important, even if they don't know much about it. And they bring very few critical prejudices with them. They basically take the stories of Scripture straight up. Hence, when we move from the stories of Abraham and Exodus into the prophets and their criticism of Israel's idolatry, the students are absolutely puzzled. God had done so many wonderful things for the Israelites, how could they become idolaters? To them, Israelite idolatry is so foolhardy as to be unintelligible. For several years, I struggled with how to answer that question clearly and effectively. Here's what I now do when that question comes up. First, I ask them how many of them went to Catholic schools. And even now, still about 60 or 65% of them will raise their hand, at least to elementary school. I then ask those students, how many of them said the Pledge of Allegiance every morning? And I know that the Catholic schools in Baltimore still do that, and I assume that's still a pretty widespread practice. And so almost all of them raised their hand. I then say, y'all, I recognize we've only read a little bit of the Old Testament, but I think you can answer this question. What does the God of Israel call it when the people of God pledge their allegiance to something that isn't God? And well, there's shifting. Eventually, one of them raises their hand and says, idolatry. And then they all get very defensive. And before that gets too far, though, I say, listen, wait, that's... Before we get too far into this, let's leave aside for the moment the question of whether saying the pledge is an act of idolatry, at least for Christians. Instead, let me ask you this question. For how many of you is this the first time in your life that you ever thought that saying the pledge might be idolatrous? And of course, every single hand goes up. That's how idolatry happens, both in the Bible and today. Nobody ever wakes up and says, oh, the sun's shining on my head. Maybe it's blinding, actually, some of you guys. And because of that, I'm going to become an idolater. Idolatry is never a single cataclysmic decision that you make. No Israelite, no Christian in America rolls out of bed and says, today I'll become an idolater. Instead, it's through a series of seemingly benign processes of habituation and small-scale decisions that you make over a long period of time, so that gradually, a little at a time, your attention is directed away from God. And then you get out of bed one morning, and instead of thinking, today I'll become an idolater, you've got Amos screaming in your face, you're an idolater! And you can't recognize anything that he's saying in your life. That's how idolatry happens, very slowly, very gradually. And by the time you get a prophet on the scene pointing that out to you, it's way, way too late. There's a deep, deep irony in the prophetic vocation, which is, when Israel is most in need of a prophet, they're in the position where they're least able to hear that prophet. The idea is to never get in that position, right? Now, I want to couple that story with a more familiar account of what happens when we get to Matthew 22:15-22, where Jesus is asked about paying taxes to Caesar. And when I ask them, what is Jesus' answer, give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, mean? It doesn't take long for someone to raise their hand and offer an answer that divides the world up into things that are God's and things that are Caesar's. I think you can imagine how that looks. And I generally commend them and recognize that this way of interpreting things is deeply embedded in the Christian tradition. But it's probably not the best way to think about Jesus' answer. I then ask them, again, based on their limited exposure to the Old Testament, if Caesar is who Caesar claims to be, what's left over for Yahweh? And if Yahweh is who Yahweh claims to be, then what belongs to Caesar? And of course, Jesus' answer in Matthew's gospel is that this is a zero-sum game. It's not an answer about paying taxes. It's a challenge to his audience to figure out where you stand and act accordingly. Taking these two stories together illustrates a fairly large and widespread threat to Christians' abilities to practice the peace of Christ in this or in any nation. Nobody would deny to God anything that's clearly God's. Like Israelite idolatry, that would be foolhardy. Nevertheless, once we begin to break up the world into pieces that belong to God and pieces that are either shared with or belong to other powers, then we've made one of those seemingly benign or even prudent and pragmatic small decisions that slowly, by degrees, shift our attention away from God and towards something else. In this way, any particular claim to loyalty that the nation may exert on the church, churches, or individual Christians becomes successively easy to negotiate, and Christians become successively less able to resist the war-making power of any nation. Of course, it seems to me the primary antidote to this is attentiveness. The attentiveness that means that you'll never find Amos in your bedroom when you get out of bed. And of course, it's not individual attentiveness only, it's corporate attentiveness. It's each of us being attentive for and with each other, too. Because our own capacities for self-deception are well documented. And we often need the attentiveness of our brothers and sisters to point stuff out to us. And of course, that's not, in addition to being corporate, it's ongoing. Because you can be attentive for today, but if you fail to be attentive tomorrow, then that gradual turning away from God continues. So the antidote, it seems to me here, the alternative, the way in which Christians will enhance their capacities to practice the peace of Christ, is corporate, ongoing, and individual attentiveness.
In the spring of 368, in the middle of Cappadocia, which is middle of modern-day Turkey, if you think of a map, I have a bad habit. When I speak about maps, I point to things in imaginary maps. Yeah, you can see it. Yeah. So if you think of Turkey, it's right there. It's in the middle of modern-day Turkey. An earthquake, one of those customary earthquakes, happens, but this is particularly devastating. It is particularly devastating because it diverts water resources. The water table shifts. Now, in antiquity, if your water and irrigation shift, it means years of famine. Not only do you lose the immediate destruction of the city, the thousands that are killed by the earthquake, but you lose the ability to irrigate your fields. You lose this year's crop, which means you lost next year's crop, which means you lost at least one more year of a crop until resources come in, et cetera, et cetera. That earthquake devastated Cappadocia for 6 years, creating tens of thousands of victims, to the point that the Persian campaign, in which the empire was engaged at that time, because Cappadocia was a border province, had to be stopped. Can you imagine the state stopping its war because it cannot feed its troops? You have marauding legions of the proto-Byzantine late Roman Empire. You have devastating, devastating earthquake. The bishop of, or one of the highest hierarchs in Cappadocia is Basil, who later became the bishop of Caesarea, writes a beautiful letter to the monks in the desert, famous letter. And he says, brothers, he says, I applaud your piety. You're so wonderful out there trying to discipline yourself to be in communion with God, to be in the presence of God. And he goes on and on and on and on for paragraphs, just praising them and raising them. And he says, but I have a question for you. Every time you see that but there, something's about to happen. Alone in the desert, whose feet are you washing? To whom are you last? He invites the clerics to, or the he invites the ascetics to come back into the city, and they do en masse. And they come back into Caesarea, and they create one of the first urban Christian centers. It was named under, by Basil's name, Vasiliados, the city of Basel. It's a city within a city. Basil and the monks take over, literally, civic administration. They build bakeries and orphanages, hospitals, hospices. They take care of the thousands of orphans that come in, of the widows, of returning soldiers, of everyone who comes to them. And that stays for centuries from that point on. The public face of Christianity ended the devastation of that city. They presented to them, to the city, what it truly means to end not only war violence, but the violence of oppression, the violence of famine. He has a beautiful homily, Basil does. It's homily 8. It's the homily called On Famine. If you want to not sleep at night, read that homily. It's homily 8. It is one of the very first public, institutional, urban Christian centers. Ambrose did something similar in Milan a few years later in the West. The irenopoietic, the peacemaking relationship of the church, of Christians, was seen in antiquity by early Christians, by medieval Christians, as all-encompassing. It didn't only mean an end with war. But war did happen. So even though we, as I spoke before, have all these Christians who write against, writers who write against war, Christianity comes into even the military ranks. Many of their young men find in the military a way to escape their poverty, to find a better future. By the way, I don't know if you know this fact, the Roman military is the only occupation and only profession in antiquity that has a pension system. You serve for 25 years and they keep every year half your salary. They literally put it aside in a pension fund. And when you retire after 25 years, they give you 30 years' pay. That's your pension. It's a very attractive proposition, especially for young men from the provinces whose farmlands have been devastated, for men from the cities who have no job. On average, in antiquity, unemployment rates range between 25 and 40%. That's the normal unemployment rate. So if somebody guarantees you employment for 25 years and a pension for the rest of your life, depending on where you are in the empire, also a plot of land, don't you take it? But it isn't just military. And the tendency is sometimes for us to limit our discussion on military. It's also, and I want to propose this for a moment for us to think through as we're coming to the end, it's also civic service. Tertullian, to whom I come often, both in writing and in thinking about this, says this. It's a little bit lengthy. If you allow me, I want to read it to you because it's just so much fun. He writes at the beginning of the 3rd century, and of course he's dealing with real people. He says this. A dispute has lately arisen as to whether a servant of God can hold a position of honor or authority if he, and always he, can keep himself free of any appearance of idolatry by means of some special grace or through his own wisdom, just as Joseph and Daniel, who served with honor and power, wearing the insignia and the purple of the government of Egypt and Babylonia, yet without being tainted by idolatry. You see what's happening, right? As the churches are growing, people are saying, you know what, the cursus honorum, the course of honor, the expected course for me as an upper-class Roman citizen is to be in public office. Though I am a Christian, what stops me from doing that? I'm going to cross my fingers and, you know, not sacrifice, or when they do, I'll just say there are no God but God, and there you go. I can do that. Tertullian says, yeah, there are some people like that. He says, let's think about this. This always cracks me up. He says, we may grant that someone could hold a position in purely honorary way if you can believe that it is possible for him to avoid sacrificing or authorizing sacrifices without paying for sacrificial animals, without making paying for the upkeep of the temples, without taking care of temple taxes, without putting the show, the spectacle that was that had to begin with sacrifices, at his own expense or at public expense or by presiding over the staging of them, without issuing solemn proclamations and edicts or even taking an oath. In other words, let's assume that you can be a public officer without doing anything a public officer does. Okay. Providing he can do this and also avoid the function of his office, that is, without making, passing judgment on a man's life, capital punishment, right, or honor, for you put up, you can put up with the decision of financial matters, without condemning or for judging, without putting anyone to chains or prison or torturing. If it's believable that all this is possible, then he may serve. But let me ask you, it gets better. What will you accomplish if you use the attire of the magistracy, but do not perform the function connected with it? Nobody can give the impression of cleanliness in unclean clothes. The office is already polluted by long-standing practice and tradition. If you put on the tunic soiled of itself, it may perhaps not be soiled through you, but certainly you will not be able to be clean because of it. So as I've been thinking about this, I think it's about time for our churches to start rethinking about the practices of medieval and earlier than that penance. In Canon 13, Basil of Caesarea speaks very specifically about those who return from military service, especially war. Canon 13 says this: "Our fathers did not consider killing commitment in the course of wars to be classifiable as murders at all. On the score, it seems to me, of allowing the pardon of a pardon to men fighting in defense of sobriety and piety. Perhaps, though, it might be advisable to refuse them communion for 3 years on the ground that their hands are not clean." Cyprian has written about that about 130 years earlier. "It is impossible," he says, "to come to the Eucharist with bloody hands." One of the things, one of the practices that Basil instituted in Caesarea was a 3-year exclusion from the Eucharist for those who returned from military service, especially from those who returned from battle. It wasn't punitive. I want you to understand this. It was not punitive. It was pastoral care. But I want to extend these 2 more steps. I want to think with you, or you to help me think through, shouldn't our congregations also go into penance for whatever amount of time we decide is appropriate because we made it possible, not only possible, but necessary for these men and women to go into battle? Is it only their sin, or is it our sin too? And we both have to confess and repent publicly. But what about public office? Can Christians hold public office? I will leave aside the oath, the pledge that one takes for public office. How can we be clean in an unclean job? You do know that we have had, in the first 4 years of this current administration, more deportations of illegal persons. How can a person be illegal? That's okay. That's another story. Than we had in 8 years of the previous administration. We had 3 times as many drone strikes in the first half of the first administration of the current administration than we had in all 8 years of the previous administration. How can a Christian come to the Eucharist clean, wearing a tunic deep in blood? It may be time for our churches and our congregation, and Steve and I do realize that we're speaking to the choir. If some of you have not left the choir already, we're within the building. But shouldn't we, in our view of nations, think not only what nations do with other nations, but what is our relationship within the nation to keep the nation accountable? I started by introducing myself as a grandson of a general and the son of a Navy captain, as one who served. Being 31 years old when I put the uniform on allowed me to see the nonsense I was fed as true. That I was formed day after day for all of that basic training to think of my brothers and sisters not only as enemies, but as ones who truly want to harm me. I could never see the Turk, in this case, any other way. From the day I was born to the day I put off the uniform, that was the narrative I was told. They're after you. He took good friends who pointed me and said, "Welcome back from military service. Now can you sit down and think about this?" To figure out that that is as far removed from the practice and understanding of what the church is as it can be. Let me close with this, because we need to have time. We promised ourselves that we would take 45 minutes. We took 45 minutes. Christians countered throughout history the Roman libido dominanti with a new language about power based on the hope of resurrection and the sovereignty of God. And the church's ethical teachings were an expression of that hope. The prohibition against killing, war, and resisting evil did not simply derive from an assumption about violence as inherently evil, but rather from early Christian understandings of the sovereignty of God. To the coercive power of the state articulating the demand for devotion to the gods of the empire or any empire, and the empire as their vicar on earth, the example of Christ provided Christians with a new interpretive matrix that allowed them to follow a completely new paradigm of power and sacrifice. And their undergirding instrumentalities of violence in all its pluriformity, including killing, based on civic disobedience and a passible co-optation of power that found its strength in nonviolent resistance in imitation of Christ. At the end, Louis Swift puts it best, I think. He says, "If violence had any place in a Christian's life, it would appear that it must be a violence which is endured rather than inflicted, a violence which is suffered in imitation of the Founder as a way of transcending human passions and breaking the endless cycles of injury and retaliation." End quote. At least I want to propose to you that that would be a good way of us beginning to think about peace among our nations. As transnational communities, as Catholic Church, as baptized into a new baptism, a new family, a new kinship. You've got to remember that we didn't used to have first names up to a few generations ago. What do we have? Christian name, right? The name that united us. There was a reason why in baptism, throughout the history of the Church, persons received a new tunic. When you came out of the waters, a new tunic was put on you. That's your citizenship. We want to leave time for questions and discussions. We thought we would have tables. We don't. But we have the floor open for the next 3 hours. So those are some thoughts that we had for you to think through and help us think through.
I think we have a...
Or should we open it first for a couple of questions? Or if there are none, then we can go into... Yes?
Loudly, though.
I appreciate you helping us recover the tradition of Irenaeus and Tertullian and Basil, and I did notice that Augustine was absent in your account. And today, today Augustine is frequently trotted out by the apologists of a certain type of civic responsibility. And so I'm wondering if that avoidance was intentional. Is there any way for those of us for whom nonviolence is central to rehabilitate or reappropriate Augustine, or is there a time to make a decision?
Thank you. Yes, it was both intentional and it was intentional. I'm Greek. For some, for us, Augustine is not a saint, but just blessed. He is. I mean, that's a historical fact. Augustine writes in a very different time. It's the topic of a subsequent book I'm working on the, what happened in the 4th century and early 5th century. And Augustine has also been not only misappropriated quite often, it has also been, especially City of God 19, has been just used almost like Romans 13. There's a lot of recovery of Augustine, good scholarship on him to show the sovereignty of God as first. The world changes in the middle of the 4th century. Yesterday, we talked about the Constantinian shift. Every time I hear that as a historian, I cringe, because it wasn't Constantine, it was Theodosius in 390, but we'll blame it on Constantine. That's okay. But the 4th century changes. Because in, what happens in the 4th century is the church moves from the margins of society into the certain center of power. It's like the dog that chases the car, right? You know, you chase after the car, chase after the car, and suddenly you grab it. Now what? What do you do with it? That's the 4th century.
Now what do you do with a car?
Now suddenly, not only can you speak to the powers, but you are the power. And in the beginning of the 5th century, by roughly 410, both East and West, the whole empire is baptized. Literally overnight. I mean, in the sequence of a few months, the whole empire is baptized. Now, not only can you speak about Christians in the military, but the military is you. Is the people who come to you. The world changes. And what I'm trying to show, both in writing and in speaking, is that the church has been captive to this for 1700 years, 1600 years. It's about time. I'm not one of the historians or theologians who laments the post-Christendom that we are experiencing both in Europe and the U.S. Actually, I love that. I yearn for that. I wait for that, for the time in which the church can truly be the church again, divested from political and secular powers and authorities. But Augustine can be rescued, because Augustine, for the most part, has been misinterpreted on this.
I'm not too sure if I've gotten the right plenary for this question. About 2 years ago, my next-door neighbor made a transition from owning a groundhog rifle and a pistol for personal protection to building a small arsenal down in his basement. And I understand this has become pretty common practice in the United States over the last 4 or 5 years. In fact, I think I'm hearing on the news that they're not able to manufacture not just pistols and but military weapons and ammunition. They're not able to manufacture those fast enough for the demand. As a peacemaker or someone that's trying to do that, I don't know if there's any historical early church story or any biblical story that you all see as a parallel, or maybe from our neighborhood plenaries. I may be just asking for prayer from this group. I don't know. But I was hoping at some point that this group, maybe if not today, at some point in the future, could take a look at what's, I think, been a pretty radical change in the culture just in the last 4 or 5 years regarding violence or the preparation for violence. Thank you.
My students, I could make one up and you'd think it was biblical. This is a different issue in different parts of our country. In urban areas, there's a lot more fear of guns and gun violence. That the guns are not, they're sort of different things in urban areas than they are in rural areas. And so I'm not sure there's a single way of thinking about that. That's part of it. If you follow up my side, Dr. Christie. You can make one up, and we really won't know.
Yeah, I can make one up. But don't romanticize the history of the world. You know, we're not more violent than the world was. You know, battles in antiquity would usually end with about 30 to 50,000 dead in a day, like slaughtered in a day. So we're not more violent. What it tells me, what that story tells me, that your neighbor is very, very afraid. Peacemaking is not only about telling him not to have guns, it's to show him what it means to be at peace.
And of course, the verse is perfect love casts out fear.
That's right. It is this breakdown of hope is because we suddenly stop romanticizing the last, 50 years, 40 years, 30 years, the immense trust we had on government. In the 50s, we had an incredible trust on government. They will take care of us, protect us, be for it, or here in the States. Y'all did. I'm not from here. We always knew what we got with government. I was born three days before a dictatorship that lasted for 7 years, that executed people. You know, I was raised through schools that talked about that. But it's about fear. It's not about guns. It's about inability to understand, even as Christians, that when we say that God is sovereign, I'm not. And being willing to leave that consequence out. But it's not just in our military or armaments, right? It's also in our health care. It's also in our 401ks. It's also in our jobs. It's also, I have a practice that I do with students and say, I want you to do this. I want you to close your eyes, play a game with me. You want to do that? Play a game. I'll give you 10 seconds. That's all. Close your eyes. When you imagine if you have children, and you project 20 years from now, what does their success look like? And if you are without children, what does success look like? What's the picture that you paint in your head? Who gave you that picture? Whatever that picture was, who painted that picture for you? That's the one who gives you the concept of security and safety. And the role of the church is to change that image. In persons, families, neighborhoods, nations.
This question is for George. I appreciate the way that you have kind of shed some light on the distinction between military and civil service. But my question is, why draw the line there? What about multinational corporations and industries and the violence that they perpetrate against humanity and creation and the ways that we benefit through employment, through financial, I mean, you kind of spoke about that a second ago. How do we grapple with that in our church?
I would say the same way. I stopped with military and civic service because these are the obvious for, you know, purposes. But yeah, I did have an open discussion with a colleague at my school whether one can be an executioner, a Christian, be an executioner for the state. Can you be the one who just pulls the levers? You go, seriously? That's your job? No, you cannot be a Christian and do that. But yes, I mean, can I be an accountant, a Christian who's an accountant and works for Enron, knowing what they do? And here's where I would say is the transposition between a noun and an adjective. Because everything around us, from churches most often to youth groups to colleges, especially Christian colleges, we have a tendency to speak of Christian as an adjective. I'm a Christian lawyer, I'm a Christian teacher, I'm a Christian doctor, I'm a Christian soldier, I'm a Christian whatever, right? So I get together with other lawyers, and what unites us is being a lawyer, and you happen to be Muslim, atheist, Jewish, Buddhist, Christian, doesn't matter, we all come together. Now let's see which decisions a Christian cannot make. But if we shift it around and say, no, the noun is Christian, I'm a Christian who happens to be in law. I'm a Christian who happens to be raised in a family. I'm a Christian who happens to be in ministry. I'm a Christian who happens to be in this neighborhood. Then the whole question changes. It says, because I'm a Christian, can I work here? Because I'm a Christian, can I live here? Because I'm a Christian, can I do that? To me, that would be a better way of, or a way through to looking and asking, what about the other job? Does that make sense?
Stanley, during his conversation with Mike, mentioned the importance of considering the witness of Gandhi. And to as far as that goes, I think that one should also consider the witness of Khan Ghaffar Khan as his Muslim counterpart. But my question has to go with a conversation that I had earlier this gathering with Reagan and some others about, and the question came up, would Gandhi be considered so crucial to the understanding of peacemaking if he had not been successful in obtaining the liberation of India from the British Empire? The narrative usually goes that he used nonviolence, that he somehow said that against Hitler, this would be ineffective, but you could use it against the Brits. And then the great failure for Gandhi is usually defined that he could not maintain the borders of India that had been established by the British Empire, as if that was necessarily what defined India. The Brits got to define India, and when Pakistan broke off, that was somehow a great failure. While one can understand the importance that Martin Luther King was able to place on the witness of Gandhi, and that Bonhoeffer was very interested in Gandhi's witness, how much does the attention paid to Gandhi play into the issue that you raised fairly early on about the efficacy of nonviolence?
Stan's comment was, to the extent I recollect it, it was, I think what he was trying to assert was that Gandhi was politically astute, and that there is a sort of sense in which the Christian witness to nonviolence should be attentive to that. But it can very, once you do that, of course, you can very easily be pulled into an account of peacemaking that's based on effectiveness rather than fidelity. I think one of the great things that George did today and his book does as well is to raise up for our attention Christians who were extraordinarily, profoundly adept at bearing peaceable witness, often at the cost of their lives. And this is not to say anything critical about Gandhi, but that the church's
make far too ready recourse to him and his story than to our own canonical figures, and who were not, for the most part, whose standards of success or effectiveness are measured in offering their lives back to God in martyrdom. So it's one of those things that if there had been time, I would have kind of tugged on Stan's sleeve and said, listen, do you really want to say just that, or maybe you should say something else? I think the political wisdom, which I think we ought to be attentive to, carries with it the very clear movement towards standards of effectiveness rather than fidelity. Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask a question.
So this has been a great presentation and a terrific conversation. I wanted to ask you to kind of bring us full circle back to the first plenary where Jana and Randy were talking about conflict within the church, because it's an interesting tension, right? I mean, you're providing what to me is a very powerful and persuasive account about what the witness of Christianity looks like relative to peace. And if we take this back to congregations, it's going to tear our congregations to pieces, right? So I just wanted to invite you to comment on the relationship between the pressing need for that witness and for truthful speech about this and the kind of conflict that that tends to create in congregations.
I can begin, because I'm going to talk about somebody else. And many of you know Greg Jones, and Greg and I were colleagues for many years. And if you know the two of us, you'll know that there are very few occasions I will say anything nice about him in public. And this is going to be one of them. Which is not because I don't like him, it's just I don't want to feed his ego. Early on in our time at Loyola, Greg and I arrived about the same time. Greg was asked by Presbyterian Church in Baltimore to come and do a series of Lenten Bible studies on homosexuality. The Presbyterian Church had just issued one of their many papers on this. And he said, no, I won't do that. What I will come and do is a series of Lenten studies on Mark's Passion narrative with you. And they said, okay. And he went out and he did that. And towards the end of that last time with them, he said, you know, as I've been talking with you and as we've been going through Mark's Passion narrative together, a couple of really interesting things have emerged for me, and I want to just sort of reflect them back to you all. The first is, and this was now 20 years ago, none of you know, or at least are aware that you know, anyone who's homosexual. So the issue you wanted me to come and talk to you about doesn't have a face for you. It's very abstract. The second thing I want to reflect back to you, and that's way more important, is that you're not really divided with each other over homosexuality. You still are fighting over the fight you had over the color of the carpet in the new sanctuary. And you still haven't resolved that. And because you haven't resolved that, you wanted me to come and talk to you about the most incendiary issue in the church right now. And the reason I wouldn't do that is because I didn't know whether you had any habits of conversation capable of taking up such an incendiary issue. So, to get back to your question, Kelly, if you don't have those habits of conversation, and I think one of the things, is Aaron still here? There. One of the things that she shared, I think, so well yesterday in her workshop was about a congregation who very painfully and over time developed habits of conversation to be able to talk about a really difficult issue without tearing each other apart. I couldn't advise you to go back to congregations and, if this is an incendiary issue for you, begin there. Begin with the easy stuff. Begin with the stuff
that you can do and talk about, so that over time and over the practice of talking and abiding with each other, you'll eventually get to something as difficult as this. But if you start at the beginning, I think you're right. You will tear each other apart if you don't have those habits of conversation, the structures of forgiveness and reconciliation in good working order, and just the long habit of abiding and sticking together, so that your brothers and sisters know that if you disagree with each other over this issue or any other issue, you're not going to turn your back on each other.
If one does the math to see how long it takes, one semester course, the material that a student or one deals with in one semester, one course, one semester, 15 weeks. If a congregation deals with the same number of material, 1 hour every Sunday for 52 Sundays, it takes 6 to 7 years to get through. That's a long time. What we thought about together for 2 days, about 30 hours, more or less, it will take your congregation somewhere between 8 and 16 months to work through. Patience. On the other hand, I'm not known for my patience. The church, as it grew, it realized that it took everybody in. Brothel keepers and prostitutes and civic servants and persons who were born in Christian families and persons who just came late in life. So how do you put it all together? All traditions of canons in the church, of how do we do life together? And especially in these categories, the church had, up to the 4th century, a very long tradition of saying something pretty simple. You cannot be a Christian and serve in the military. And actually, the apostolic tradition in the canon of Hippolytus, canon 14, says, if you are in the military, and remember, Romans don't have conscientious objectors. If your head objects, lose it. Kind of thing. You have to refuse to kill. You have no option as a Christian. If you are converted in the military, you have no option to kill. You have to refuse. That's going to jar a number of us and a number of our congregations. But any of you have ever remodeled a room know that some things need to be broken down in order to be rebuilt. Yes, we need to come and patiently, long and trusted, work with one another. But at some point, there are some things we cannot give up. I get this question quite often from young men, especially men at our place, because we have ROTC program, to say, I want to go and serve my country. I want to be a witness for Christ in a place that is so dark and needs Christ's presence, such as the military. My response is usually, so do brothels. Why don't you go and work there? And it jars them. It just, yeah. You go, why is one an option and the other not an option? I mean, why is one acceptable and the other not acceptable? But until they see the starkness of the comparison, they just cannot think about that.
That is a beautiful end point for a session that in the schedule is scheduled to run from like 3 to 4:30 or something. So I'm glad everybody showed up in the room. Would you join me in thanking George?